going on in the people's room. It has nothing to do with prayer or anything. In that moments of complete silence.
Yeah, well.
This is what is being transferred.
But this is the part you're talking about. Automatic, he didn't seek it.
No, well, that's what I'm saying. This is what is flowing to the individual. This is what Jesus is saying. When two or three are gathered in my name, there am I in the midst. Mm-hmm. Which is strictly a bringing together of consciousness. And the first thing you begin to perceive or experience is bliss or peace. Then this consciousness, this extrasensory nature, and this strength comes to you.
What did you say?
Strength.
Thank you. I didn't understand the word.
See, that the strength comes out of the person eventually. But without that strength, he has nothing to go on.
It's a beautiful breakdown of the word meditation. Run through that again, since I don't think they probably ought to be with you, but I wouldn't.
Well, it's mental energy directing individual thought activities towards an intuitive or independent of the senses observation and oneness of the noumena.
We'll write that for you.
I don't know if this thing Prashad made for me.
Good.
Sorry,
we had to really push it down. Yeah.
Where's the prasad? It's in the refrigerator.
Okay,
it's in the refrigerator, and it's a dipper.
We always seem to be caught in that question. If you taste salt water, and he tastes salt water, is your salt water saltier than his salt water from the same cup? Huh? You may have a bigger mouthful than he has a bigger mouthful, but salt water is still salt water. This is the question. When we say a master is more supreme, there's no such thing.
Yeah, I remember after you told me that I should pray to the form, to God.
I didn't say the form, I said to God, not the form.
Yeah, that's what I was doing.
Pray to God, not the form. The form is only a garment in which God is passing through. Now let's put it on this way. What's the difference between wearing a tunic shirt and wearing a shirt like his? It's a shirt. The collar may be made different, but it's still a shirt. It still has sleeve, still have a yoke, still a front and a back. See? It's the form may be a little different. It's still got a collar, it's got a front and yoke and everything, but it still classifies a shirt. This is what we're trying to understand. Don't get carried away that one master is greater than the other. They're not. It's kind of ridiculous to say that one master is greater than the other. Once you have arrived in God realization, there is no difference. But they may have different roles of work to do. They may have different responsibilities. This can only be the difference in them. As far as the realization goes, there's no difference in the realization. Again, this is another misleading thing. Because are the people, some people loyal to the form of Jesus and they wouldn't accept your modern present masters in their form? Now, is the life in this present master any different than the life within Jesus? And any different than the ant that crawls the ground? the current in this building passing through so many different watts of bulbs. Still 110 volts. Well, one bulb may got a 30 watt, 50 watt, 80 watt, 100 watt. Don't make any difference. It's the same 110 volts got to pass through all of them. So, there again is the conflict in the question.
Is what you're loyal to the truth rather than to any particular master anyway?
The truth is, these things are what makes people get tied up in there and lose sight of what they're searching for or what they're aiming at. There's only one truth, the road from birth to death and the life after the body form. And the one truth is how to behave in a human body and how to realize the life principle that this body is held up by. There is no other truth. Now, whatever human being can make you aware of this, that individual you have some respect for, but not the individual himself, because the individual himself still has to discover this for himself. It's the principle behind the individual that you have the respect for. You respect the person for having made the attempt to achieve this realization. See, my respect for Charan Singh and Kirpal Singh and all these masters is not because of their body. My respect is the fact that it's a human form that made the accomplishment which I am part of. This is my realization. This is my respect. My respect is not that I worship the man. I worship the principle which has come down and used a physical frame to make an example of itself. Therefore, it's the principle behind it, the thing you're thinking of all the time. But you need some reference point. So, as I would like them all to come in the room, not just one. I welcome them all. My loyalty is to all of them, not to one. This is a kind of for me, I said no for you. For me, I love them all equally. I welcome them all equally. Because in their own words, I have to take their own words. The things I do, you shall do also, and greater things shall you do. Now, one, the first statement, they have established equality. Two, they have made me conscious of my own God nature. In that one statement, the things I do, you shall do also. That's equality. And greater things shall you do, which is that each one must realize his own God nature sooner or later. Not just to look at him from a state of equality and then eventually turn down and want to worship him. Even Jesus who says, get thee behind me, Satan, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Not me, Jesus, before the principle. Thou shalt have none other graven image or form before the principle. It's the principle that you're looking at. This is the loyalty. This is where the real loyalty lies. Because the frame is the instrument you have to work with. And the loyalty is to recognize that through this physical frame, a principle decided to make itself known. This is a respect for a living master, not the man himself. The fact that living masters will always be with us. It's not the end all or the first all that one master comes and living masters will always be with man, because living masters are an example of the principle in flesh.
Is it helpful to think of that living master as a reference point, so that when you think of him, you automatically think of the principle behind it? It's a little bit difficult to think about an abstract principle.
Yes, that's why Jesus used it, the thing. You see, I am the advocate, the I am principle. You see me, you see the Father. And this is the way of righteousness. These were all incentives to help you to bridge between the abstract and the human part of your nature. You see, we need some example. So we labor under the condition that we have a soul and we are searching for divinity. Now, not knowing that we are soul, we can't bridge this condition. Now, seeing someone who knows his soul, this someone helps us by example to bridge it. Now, whatever incarnation that someone comes in, it is still the principle behind it that is bringing you back. You see, it's not so much the form. If you say Master Charan Singh's body in this incarnation, they call him that. He might have another name in another incarnation, or in some other name for something. That's not the question. The question is that wherever this principle would make itself manifest as soul to those who think they have a soul, this principle will have to use flesh or a form to shock us to the reality that we are soul. It'll have to take that physical form to break this concept in us. So our loyalty, our respect goes to that period where this association is. I know it's a difficult thing to adjust to, but we all want something tangible to hold on to. And we can't seem not to want the tangible and to live with the inner consciousness. You see, the master will point out to you that you have to meditate. Now, many of us can write and ask for initiation, but doesn't he not tell you to meditate and read his writings? Why would the master himself, if he is the human form, why would the human form tell you to meditate or read his writings if initiation be the only thing then? It isn't the initiation or not being initiated or being initiated that is going to make the person change. It is the individual who has to meditate. You can be initiated now by the master. And if you don't meditate, the initiation isn't doing you any good. Like, all right, put food in front of a person who has just eaten a meal. Is he going to eat? He's not hungry. Until you're hungry, you would eat. So, what the masters are saying, that if we understand that we have to take this process of meditation on an individual basis, we have to approach it as a day-by-day transformation of our nature, then, through their intercession by the initiation, they can bridge now the form with the abstract. They can bridge the possibility of you comprehending a divinity in flesh or appreciating divinity in flesh. It's possible for them to help you bridge this condition. Now, in my own case, I didn't go to see Yogananda. But I realized time and place would not separate a master from the disciple getting initiation. Lahiri Mayasha had such a man too. There was a man who couldn't see Lahiri Mayasha. Yet Lahiri Mayasha appeared to him in one night and initiated him, and that was it. The man was doing his meditation. It's the meditation that sets up the field, that sets up the necessary conditions to draw the master to you. He cannot come to you if you don't set up these conditions for him. He cannot impose. He's not the type of consciousness that would impose upon another person. He doesn't impose wisdom on a human being. The radio transmitter or the TV transmitter does not impose upon your machine and cause you and flip it on for you to look at it. unless you don't turn on your own set in your house, it's not going to come in. He's going to be there all the time broadcasting 24 hours a day. But until you make the necessary adjustments on your set to bring it in, you would not make a contact. And it's the same thing with the masters. Until you decide to meditate and pull this consciousness, they don't come. Now, they'll come in as soon as you make the adjustments. And once you're on their beam or their channel, then you're hooked into them. And that is what initiation is supposed to represent for you. Yet you are hooked into their particular frequency. Now, if you, let's say you turn a TV set on, and you don't set the dial right, you set it in between 11 and 12, or between 7 and 8. Are you going to get channel 7 or are you going to get channel 8? You're in between. You know what I mean? So you're going to fluctuate. So the initiation is only to put you in line with that particular consciousness and channel, so that that particular frequency flows to you. And that is what is called a link with the master, or a link with that channel. You're now tuned into channel 12 or whatever it is. When you're playing the set, you're not interested in the broadcasting studio no more. You're interested in the program that is coming through the set. Now, when you're hooked into the master, what you're interested in is your realization that comes out of it. If the master is there as the transmitter and the beaming of the energy, but if you don't work on this realization as to where you are, you have the same thing. You're trying to use a master as a rabbit foot. You think of him in some kind of a way that's going to solve problems. It's good to think that. I'm not saying no. Then you're in need, you're calling a master. But the master is not trying to make out to you that he's going to solve your problems. A master is adding comfort. Or in fact, he's giving you problems to make you grow. He's going to pull the rug out from under you to extract the strength out of you. You understand? So if he doesn't do that to you, you don't know if you got any strength. He's going to give you disappointments just to find out how much you love him. So if the more disappointments he gives you, the more persistence you have to him, he'll get so fed up and just, okay, have it. And that's what the mother does to the child, that is always bawling all the time. Okay, here's the lollipop, keep quiet. Right. So that's the same thing. The one who keeps molesting these masters, sooner or later, like Yogananda kept molesting Sri Yukteswar till Yukteswar gave him the cosmic consciousness. See, sometimes that has to be the way. Sometimes we're only content with certain things. No, we have to meditate. If you don't meditate, I don't know how. It's possible by the grace of God or love of God that you can have. It's not impossible. Nothing is impossible. God giving you His blessing and pulling you out. But everyone that I've read or heard of, they all meditated at some time or the other. Now, you see, I know it's difficult to think, and each one is saying his master or that master is better than it, and I don't see any difference in these masters. No. I didn't say not to the form. I said when you think of the master, you automatically think of form. But don't try to hold on to the form. Think of the consciousness in that form.
So I should just draw the form from my mind.
Well, the form helps. Don't get me wrong, that the form don't help. The form helps if we cannot hold on to the formless, if we cannot hold on to the eternal consciousness or the principle. The form helps us. Now, K. Manchester lived here in this town, and we went through this with, I went through the same conversation with K. And she was seeing her master in form every day, until one day she didn't see no form, and she wanted to know what became her master. And then the master showed her that he was formless, and it wasn't her, the form that was important. Then she woke up out of the dream that the form was important. And she began then to meditate on the light she saw inside herself. She used to see every form inside of the master. And she even told me this. The last moment, she saw the master like a seed. His entire face and whole body like a seed. Move right out into light, where the life stream was coming from. And as soon as that seed entered the life stream, that seed broke up into millions of pieces, into nothing. And the master was gone. From that day on, she never saw the master's face no more. And she started to grieve. And then the master came, and she heard his voice. I'm life. Don't hold on. Then she began to really meditate, because it was a light she was seeing now for herself. And I said to her, hey, this is what I'm talking about. That's why I didn't go and see Yogananda. She said, I realize why you didn't go. It's because when you see the form, and that shock comes at it, the form has to be broken from your mental attachment. You begin to grieve so much that you don't want to meditate no more. Because you've lost that master form, which now was something you were clinging to. You were not clinging to the thing that made the form. You still were clinging to the image. Thou shalt have no graven image before me, the eternal principle. But it has to bring you to a point where it has to break you from it. So if it breaks you from the form, and then allows you to experience, that's why Jesus says, the things I do you shall do also. And greater things, meaning that you will eventually see this light, this consciousness as being responsible for you. It's a big difference, as this being, it is a thing that causes you to exist. You are the result of this thing. So this is what is the real master. This is the real master, the life, God itself. But the human form eventually brings you there, by this slow process of bringing you to it. And this was her own personal experience of seeing it in herself, and she then realized. She used to see him physically, a human body. Then gradually, she said, it shrunk and shrunk till it became a seed. And just the head only, in this seed. And as it went back into the pure life current, where it came from, burst itself into millions of pieces of light. And she said from that day on, she never saw the form no more. She began to grieve.
I imagine in the early stages, this was comforting in a sense, of being able to see the form itself. And that's important.
Well,
I mean, there's a personal implication.
Yes, the thing is this, once you're initiated by a human master, and the human contact, and the love and the affinity and the joy of communion, you want that, because remember this, we are all part human. This is not, don't get it wrong. There is respect for this form. There is a love, there's a gradual attachment growing there too. Now, you see this thing inside of yourself, and when you're not with the person, the only thing you have is a photograph to remind you of the person, of your association. You may have a few recordings of their voice, you understand, to remind you of that association. But then you try to go inside here, and you try to see a mental picture of what they would look like. So you're still holding, you see. Now, remember, these are all essential ways to gain strength. There comes a time when the strength has to prove itself. Is it the form that maintains its strength, or is it the strength maintained by the divinity that is going to come into you? Is it, you see what I mean? Where are you going to really get your strength from? Are you getting the strength from the form, or are you getting the strength from the divinity? If you're getting your strength from the form, then you're in for a big surprise, because it's going to let you down. It's going to come a time and it's going to break up, and there will be no form to rely on. You see? And that's what you say, the form is gone now, but what is left for you is the divinity to face, your own divinity, your own consciousness. Now, what has been planted in your mind through that form, what that form has passed on to you in some tangible way, in voice, in expression, in human contact, this will stay with you. This will nourish your love. And this will help you to hold on now to the pure divine presence until this divine presence starts taking over you yourself. And then you will find that your guru now, or a spiritual master, is far more alive with you than ever before. Now Kay told me this herself. She says now she appreciates her own guru for the first time, because she doesn't have to see him, but she knows his consciousness passes through her for the first time.
Well, I imagine that at first I really think that now you know the form is discarded.
Right.
Yeah. It is it would be a definite sign of growth.
Yes.
Well, Donald, yeah. One thing I just couldn't understand, I mean, I was just trying to figure out ever since the summer, was when you said just forget about everything else and just pray to the form. And you said, can you pray to the form?
Well, I was trying to break you off from certain things in order to get you conscious of... You see, I told you, pray to the form. Knowing, it's like what you say, don't eat the fruit in the garden. And I knew you would not pray to the form. So I said, don't pray to the form, which I knew you would have to pray to the form. Well, right. But how am I going to help you across the barrier? You see, to tell you what to do in order for you not to do what, you see, what I want you to do, I would not openly help, you see. You have to put the consciousness in such a way it will refuse to do in order to do. So it helps the person. The person doesn't know they're being helped until they do it. Then you see that they have been helped to get to the point. So you begin now to realize that both are essential, but both have their places. And eventually it falls into place, that the form has a place in your growth, and the formless or no form eventually is the end of the growth. But how are you going to help a person to make this adjustment? Only by the cat and mouse play of the consciousness. That's why God did that to Adam and Eve. This interplay. How are we going to make this change? You see, to say not to do in order to do. So, well, this is a technique of how to get the person across that barrier. But you see, you got past it, and you're okay now, inside.
So should
you
forget about all the
things? He's
persistent. And yet, there has to come a time in our growth where we master practice. It's got to be the personal thing.
Yes, every master does that to every student. You see, the master's way of teaching is not written down in books. It's an interplay between their consciousness and your consciousness, and in certain ways, they don't even make you aware of it unless you react too violent to it. It's after years of meditating and seeing how, like, Louise would say, there's a dirty trick they're playing on you every day. I like the way she puts it, it's a dirty trick they're playing on you, but it's in order to get you across what you don't want to get across. But this is essentially what it boils down to. They're helping you to get across certain psychological barriers or obstacles, which normally we would not attempt to get across. You follow me? We wouldn't even make the attempt because we know of the complications that are going to involve. So they present it in such a way that it would appeal to us so that we do make the attempt on in regard. They know we're gonna where we're going is where they want us to go. And we don't know that's where they want us to go in the first place. But if they told us to go there outright, we wouldn't go. And Master, I remember one time Master Yogananda said in one of his writings to some student, if I told you to go that way, you wouldn't go, so I'm giving you the candy to go this way. And he's holding the candy this way, and really, really wants the boy to go. So by not making it too harsh, he has to sugarcoat it to get him across the psychological problem. It is a way in which you help the person, because remember, you tell somebody to do something, and this is a human brain, it's a human mechanism. There are two things he's going to do. Resent it right away, because he feels he's being imposed. Or, he do it just to please you, not really to please himself. Now, which is it? To please you, and not to please himself, he doesn't learn anything. He resents it, he doesn't learn anything. But if you try, you can get him across these two conditions by putting it this way and wanting him to go that way, or pulling him this way to make him go that way, sooner or later he's going to be so confused he's going to go where you want him to go in the end. And he's going to break the concept in himself. He himself is going to break it. He's going to see the obvious thing. And so he breaks the situation and he's free. This is what you're trying to say. Well, this is what they call psychiatry too, you know. A psychiatrist does the same thing when they want to help a person pass a certain problem. They have to help them that way. And it's a good way to... Now you see, in the olden days, they used to have confession. They say confession is good for the soul. So at night when the sisters and the brothers all finish their work, the sister superior would be sitting down on her table there, and all the sisters will come in, and they'll prostrate themselves and beat themselves in the chest. I was a naughty girl today. I look at Sister Mary this morning, and I could have stepped on her corn. You know? And the other says, I wish I had dropped the hot water in your head. Well, they're making confession. It's good for the soul. They're getting rid of their animosities in front of a third party or a second party. Well, it's the same way. In a way, it's a way of how to make adjustments mentally to yourself, which is mental health. You're achieving the mental health you want. You're achieving the direction of consciousness. Now, remember this. When a master comes into your life and he grants you the initiation, he takes you up to a level to where you can stand on your own. Right now, none of us can really say he can stand on his own in his inner consciousness, because we're still trying to realize ourselves. We're not masters yet. I'm not a master. I'm still trying. I'm a disciple just trying to realize myself. But it's through the meditative process you discover what is your shortcomings. You discover where you are. And this is the gist of experience you're passing on to the next person to help him across the barriers. Now, a master comes along, he had to meditate too, you know. He didn't just overnight get it. There's many lives of incarnating, and meditating he solved these problems too within himself. And he is helping you to get across to a point where he knows now that you will have to eventually stand on your own. That's why I say Jesus, when he said, the things I do, you shall do, and greater things shall you do. That is, he's establishing equality with you, and then he's establishing the godness within you. And you begin to realize what they're trying to do. Once you begin to realize what they're trying to do, then you cooperate with the form. But you don't grieve when the form is gone now. Remember, the disciples of Jesus begin to grieve. Even they were caught in the form too, you know. They grieved. And they had to come out of the form eventually. like Paul, he came out of the form, and he realized that the thing was the Christ self. That's why Paul's writings today, now it's what the church has accepted to be the whole gist of Christianity, because he was able to break away from the form into the pure truth. You see? But they haven't really investigated the writings of John, because John is strictly personal experience from within. This is the revelation. That's why John is, in my thinking, is superior than Paul's writings. Paul's writing was colored in this aspect, or was slanted from, because he was dealing with Greek and Roman environment, therefore he concentrated on a Greek-Roman audience in his writings. But John was not. He was writing strictly from what went on within himself and what occurs within everyone's self. And he showed that it was in what occurs in us is strictly abstract, is strictly impersonal. That's why he says, in this throne of consciousness, right here, and that's why his very first statement of his writings was, he didn't say, may God the Father made the earth. He says, in the beginning was the Word. He made it very clear and straight as an abstract principle. And the Word was with God. And the Word was God. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt in man. He hit out every aspect and made us conscious of what we had to live with. You see? Then he went on into his revelations, revealing the seven levels or chakras, making us conscious that we have an electrical anatomy that deals with our makeup, and that this was our divinity we had to turn to eventually. We had to go back to this divinity, that this divinity was already established for us. Now, and he also made us conscious of the fact that master, the attitude of a master's life was the key. That his master Jesus showed the attitude was that was necessary to go inside, and that was the key. That attitude was the necessary key. Those 12 Beatitudes were the necessary keys or the necessary way to look inside. See, and that is why we find that he is more specific in telling us today how to apply meditation in our lives. Because the object of the meditation is to see this electrical nature of ourselves. Now, there is no loss. The gentleman thinks when you go inside, you lose everything. And it's kind of ridiculous. What are you going to lose? If God already made you this way, what are you going to lose? He made you a physical form. He made you an electrical form. And he made you an ideational form. All you're going to see is shirt on the shirt and on the pants. You discard your back where you are in your birthday suit. So when you break through the three levels of your makeup, physical level, electrical level or astral level, idea level, you see yourself as pure life. This is what the master of K was showing her in herself. He was showing her that she too had to return to the pure life. She broke through these levels and she saw for herself what she had to, what he was passing through.
And it's true all the time. It's just pure realization.
Yeah. Now, he asked me a question and says, if I know I'm God, that destroy that thing. What can it destroy? There's nothing to lose. Knowing God is the fact that you've discovered for the first time that you're a human being. Until that time, you don't know you're a human being. You're still always laboring under some illusion. You don't appreciate the humanness of this mechanism. The humanness don't mean its fragility. Most people think because you're human, you're fragile, you know. It's untrue. In the human structure, it's written in the Hindu scriptures, it says, even the angels envy it because they would like to experience birth in it in order to praise the Lord. And Hebrew scriptures, they said the same thing. Blessed is the birth of the soul in the body. So, if this angelic beings who want to have an experience of choice, you know, the experience of feeling the humanness of their nature, we can only appreciate this when we discover God in ourselves. We don't really appreciate the humanness until that time. Because that's the first time you become a natural person. See, spiritual realization is not a holier-than-thou attitude. You see the spiritual people as they fully are, they're the most natural people in the world. So natural that you're just rushing out to help them. You think they're helpless people, they're not. It's because they're natural, their simplicity, their joy, they're flowing. I think there was once a gentleman who came and lived in your apartment or your house, Sri Ram, from the Theosophy.
Oh, I can't think of what it was, do you know?
Sri, not Sri Ram.
Oh, Sri Ram, yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Wasn't there a naturalness that's flowing out of the person?
Yes. Yes,
that's what I'm trying to say. When you are in that, this is a natural flow, then you see the humanness of the thing. You begin to see for the first time with the naked eye the divinity is human. Not that there's some human being sitting on the throne. This is what we must not get confused with. That when we use the word human, it's somebody sitting on the throne. We're not talking of
doesn't
that.
Doesn't that word H-U mean God? Or stand for the God-man?
Yeah. It's a Mexican word, too. Uh-huh. It was See, the Mexicans their high priests were called the Hugh.
Oh.
H-U. Mm-hmm. And in, there's a place in Thailand where there's a tribe called the Hugh tribe.
Oh. Well, somewhere I picked up the idea that this H-U represented something higher than just man at the animal level, and that when you put them together, you had more of a connotation of a God-man.
Look at it this way. Look at it this way. Look at this another way. Instead of saying H-U, let's call it H-E-W. What would we call H-E-W?
Cut out or hewn.
Right. You're hewing out, mm-hmm. for the first time, man.
Mm-hmm. With a capital M.
Right. The divinity is hewing out, or chiseling out for itself, man, mm-hmm. out of this condensation of consciousness and energy, is hewing out this man. Because we say, man ought to be perfect like his father in heaven. In other words, it's chiseling out or chopping out or carving out of organized matter, man, in his purest natural state. Now, the closest thing we can see of man in his purest natural state is a baby just born. We see the pure innocence, we see the thing. But let's take this extended form of the baby now and extend it to full growth without any defiling of its mechanism. Where there's no impurities coming in, physical, mental, or otherwise. And we see the same naturalness. It's flowing back to the person. Then we realize it has been hewed out of the organism. This thing, this particular condition has been hammered out. And the guru is one who lifts you out or makes you conscious of it in yourself.
It seems, as far as the mind is concerned, it's such a logical sort of thing. You wonder at your inability to make it an integral part of your cellular structure so that you feel it all the way through and operate each day from this premise. But we get lost in our old ideas somehow, I guess because they've been so deep-seated.
Yeah. You see, the process is a beautiful process. This process of meditation, it's so beautiful. Each level is so beautiful that we don't begin to realize how beautiful this growth is from level to level. every little ache, every little pain, every little disappointment, every little challenge is a beautiful process. Because what is it really trying to accomplish? It's trying to accomplish inner strength in us and inner peace. But it can't do it without that, without those conditions. It could never really make, we could never really make it without those conditions. Now, it's not making for miracle, because if we were making for miracle, the whole of life is a miracle. It has been proven and shown that the closer you are to the natural state of life, the more nature around you responds to your thinking.
To your thinking.
Yeah. The closer you live to the naturalness of yourself, anything you should think or need, nature would seem to bring into manifestation quicker. Now, Yukteswar put it another way. He says, the deeper the realization of the man, the greater is his influence on nature or creation.
Scroll that again.
The deeper the realization of the man, the greater is his influence on creation.
Well, it reaches a place where you can say to that mountain, be removed.
Right.
Be removed.
Now, what is the deepness of his realization that would produce this particular power that would respond? What is it? It would only be that he would have to be living so close to a natural state. In other words, he would be just a slight ripple on the ocean. He's not even a wave yet. He just, this is the closest natural condition you can ever get from this water. And you and the water is just vibrating. You see, this consciousness would be so stilled and so natural that anything that will go into it will germinate and react. And it stems from the very attitudes that Jesus is speaking of. Pure in heart sees God. As a man thinking in his heart, that's what he is. Now, strictly, it's not the organ of heart. If this was the case, it's only because we have been conditioned to refer to this organ as the seat of consciousness. It's not the seat of consciousness. In the ancient days, they could not refer to inner consciousness. The location in the anatomy did not have a way to refer to it. They always thought that everything had a heart, and the heart was the central core, or the important part of any object. So by referring to man's heart as the central core, or the uttermost or innermost portion of his mechanism, where everything would be pure and sacred, would be stored up in, they made that reference point to it. But in reality, what is sacred and pure in man is his consciousness. That's where it is, you see. Now, but when they refer to the pure in heart, in a deeper aspect, it refers to something entirely different. The heart itself is an organ that pumps the blood, and it decarbonizes the blood and throw off the waste products and retain the pure products in its mechanism to continue the circulation. Now, this decarbonizing process leads to an electromagnetism of the cells, and it leads to a regeneration of the human body. Now, the purification is what generates greater light in the brain. Now, when we do our prayers, or naturally when we meditate at night or we fall asleep, nature herself is performing this purification. So it says that Kriya Yoga is a simple technique of decarbonizing the venous blood, and that's to throw off its carbon and utilizing the added oxygen in its atoms to transmute this body into energy, which is God. So when it says, the pure in heart sees God, in a deeper aspect we're saying, when this mechanism, this heart mechanism, can, by our conscious awareness, decarbonize the blood, it will transform this body into pure energy, or pure light. And you would perceive this in yourself, because this decarbonation is going on, you see. Now, but it takes the mind to concentrate on it, and it takes the mind to perceive it. Also, it takes one very important ingredient, and I think it's the only ingredient. We can forget all the rest. This one ingredient is the greatest. It takes love.
Yeah, well, that's what you were saying.
We can meditate with technique and do all the techniques and still have no love, and it don't work. And you can meditate without a technique, but a sheer love, and it will work.
How do you build that?
Well, let go, let God, you see? Or surrender, don't do anything, God will do it for you. But love him. You see, Jesus was smart, very, very smart. He said, above everything else, just do these two things. Love the Lord thy God with all your mind, all your heart, and all your soul, or strength. In other words, if you sit down to meditate, don't have no other thought in your mind or in your whole mechanism but the feeling of love. Because with this feeling, the Creator himself has automatically drawn into you. He can't resist your love. If you sit down, an animal is here, I've proven this, I sit down and just feel love. Don't think of nothing else but love. And I've seen the animals just come over.
Gravitate too.
Yeah, and they start purring and making all kind of noises to illustrate that they recognize love flowing to them. Birds, I see them chirping, I see the same thing in the little insects. So I look at this illustration of love. I said, well, imagine the great creative intelligence with all the masses walking around in the atmosphere. They got to come sooner or later. See? And that's why I meditate on this love. Now, Yogananda used to meditate and pray for himself years ago. Then all of a sudden he says he stopped. And all he prays is that, may thy love shine on the sanctuary of my devotion, that I may be able to awaken thy love in all hearts. He said that from that day on, cosmic consciousness was ever so stronger in his awareness. The feeling of this presence was greater. From that clue, gave me the other clue now, what I should do, go back to what Jesus said, sit down and just generate love. You see? Now, in love, there is no thought of the mind going to the past, and there's no thought in the mind going to the future. So the mind don't want to drift into the past, it doesn't want to drift into the future. And if it drifts into the past, there's no frustration because it's love. Even what the mistakes that were there, I still begin to love them now. You understand? And if it's drifting out into the future, where anxiety will be, I still love. See? So there will be no frustration or anxiety in the concept of love. You begin to see now why Jesus emphasized this principle as being the ideal in meditation. You see?
Well, I thought I saw also what something came to me, at least, what it meant to that the pure in heart shall see God. But you've extended it even farther than I could even begin to conceive of. Because as far as I had gone, it made sense that the pure in heart would see God. However, I haven't unraveled the other, the attitudes.
Well, see, God is consciousness and light already, and it's energy. Now remember, he's locked up in this mechanism. He's smart enough to slow himself down and become this mechanism. He's smart enough to hide himself in the mechanism. You know, the Indians in the reservation, when they make a blanket, they'll tell you that there is one thread where they brought the spirit out.
Where they brought the spirit out?
Yeah. See, they'll start weaving. And they'll keep weaving with the ongoing. And they says when they weave with their spirit, their whole heart and feeling. And they've got the one thread, and it's called the master thread. And you'll never find a knot. If you can find that master thread, you can pull it, and the whole thing will loose itself from back into one long thread. You say, well, if you can find that master thread, you can search the whole thing and still can't find it. But they know, they can come to it exactly where that master thread and pull it. And the whole thing will come apart as one big thing. Remember, in Jesus' the robe that his mother made, for him, his garment, that they couldn't cast lots for it, they couldn't divide it up, because it was a master garment made with one thread. It will start unraveling itself.
That's that perfect robe.
So the Indians on the reservation, they make their blankets like that, and they have retained that technique of weaving this thing and keeping that one thread. And it's hard to find. You would not find it if you don't know where it is. You can search that whole rug. And it looks, you think you found it, but you haven't found it. And they know exactly where it is, and they can pull it. And just start unraveling itself right back. So they said they bring the spirit out true, because that's it. Well, the idea is that in meditation, we have the same kind of a principle going on in ourselves. That we can go into our consciousness, and by the love itself, pull this force in. Now, again, Yogananda said in one of his writings, he says, Divine Mother will give you anything you ask her for, except her love. But if she does give you her love, she has given you her entire self. Now that's quite a statement. Divine Mother is only an aspect of God. It's not God will give you everything except His love. He wants your love for Him. He wants you to love Him. That's the reason Jesus says, love the Lord thy God with all your mind, heart, and soul. Love your neighbor as yourself. He didn't say, God will love you. You understand? Now the Master says, God will give you everything except His love. But if He does give you His love, He gives you Himself. In other words, when you reach cosmic consciousness, the love of God is coming into you. Do you follow that? When a person has experienced cosmic consciousness, then the love of God is flowing in that person. There's a big difference to say that he's getting his prayers answered, or whatever he wants will materialize for him. Because if the love of God flows through a person, there are two distinct things the Master says you will know that the love of God is flowing through that person. One, the room is always flooded with a perfume. Even if they're not there, there's a perfume will come. That is the love of God. It's like a perfume. The second one, the love of God, is you'll always see a flash of light. And I've seen this. One time I went to visit Sister Diamato at SRF. And I couldn't get to see her because she was in meditation. They told me she was in meditation. But I passed the room where she was meditating, just past it, to feel the vibration. And I can smell the rose perfume. It's a strange rose perfume. It's not rose. It's not even standard. We don't know how to describe it. It's an unusual odor. And it's a sweet perfume, and it just flows through. And you know that the Master's love, or God's love, is just flowing through. And this, I realize how this love is flowing out. One night I was meditating. I was in a desert. I was meditating for a long time. I'd already given up that this love of God will ever flow in me. I said, well, the time I give up, because I'm not going to merit anything in divine eye. And to my surprise, I smelled this perfume in the room. Well, I thought it was aftershave lotion, you know, I thought one of the boys had aftershave. I started looking around, no. I can smell this thing for, well, I didn't say anything. I'm sitting down, and there's a fellow, a friend of ours, he doesn't believe in none of these spiritual subjects. And he likes to drink. And he walked in. He said, Adano, are you turning a woman or something? You got perfume all around you? I said, what do you mean perfume? He said, yeah, I smell perfume. He said, so somebody give you a present or something? And he's probably drunk. He doesn't really smoke. I said, no, George. He said, man, this is very strong. He says, no, I never smell this kind of perfume. He had a glass of rum and coke. It was the funniest thing to see. He keeps sniffing, and the sooner the rum and coke now had no appeal to him. He said, now, he says, I can enjoy this kind of perfume. And he said, no, because he lost himself about nearly half an hour just trying to sniff up this odor in the room. And I'm looking at that, trying to die with laughter, because I know what's happening. This thing came in so strong. Well, I thought it was my imagination. I thought this is imagination, because he's drunk. If anything can happen, you know, something can trigger them. But in walking two other fellas, and they're so cold sober. After a few minutes in the room, one fellow says, somebody got perfume in this room? I says, no. He says, well, I smell it very strong. Strange, you never smell like this perfume before. So when they went away, I said to myself, well, I got the proof of what this divine love really is. It's not hallucination, because if it was hallucination, nobody else would, but myself would have the experience, you see. Then I realized that God does manifest his love. But he's very stingy with it. Not every time, you know. You gotta be a good boy in order for him to give it to you.
You get as you give.
Right. You got the right answer. This is where I realize that there is no something for nothing with God. The more love you give him, the more he gives you back. In other words, it's how much love you can turn loose to him. That's how much love he will turn back to you. And I tell you, you can meditate for weeks, months, trying to turn loose this love, just to get 5 seconds of what he turns back. And it's worth it.
Well, Madonna, don't you sometimes feel compelled to put it out from your meditating? To let it flow through?
Well, if you do that without divine consent, you're imposing your ego again. See, if you are generating love for God, you can actually sense when he's going to release his love through you in that perfume. It's a funny phenomenon how it comes. It's like somebody, you ever see, you wind up those walking toys, and then you wind up and it starts to run? You can feel this energy being wound up all along these centers in your back. And it seems like it comes out of you. Well, I read where Yogananda, one of the masters, you know, he used to go into meditation. And all of a sudden, he started to perspire profusely all over, and this perspiration would throw off this perfume. When he comes out of it, the room is just flooded with the perfume. And he mentioned too that when the divine wants to release this love through the mechanism, you can feel that it's being wound up and it's released. And this is why there is no part of our ego can get into it, because the divine don't release it through an ego mind. Mataji. That is Anandamayi Mataji, Anandamayi, the mother, not the disciple. She put it this way: the love of God flows when there is total surrender in the mind. One fellow went to see her, his name was Bob Raymond. He's a SRF student. And he stayed there for about 3 months. Didn't get an interview with her. She was there, you know. And she was always in meditation. Never talked to nobody. Once in a while, she'd say a few words in Bengali. And then she was coming down the corridor one day. She says, normally you don't get to see these people straight up. And they're there, you can see them, but you can't get close to them. And she was coming down the corridor one day, and he was coming around, and they met. And she says, he said, her eyes opened up. She was like this, straight, and looked at him for a brief second. And then she spoke in Bengali. And the interpreter interpreted what she said. And this is what he said. She said, the love of God flows freely when you have total surrender in the mind. And she kept on walking where she was going. And he says, from that day on, it was a struggle for him then to learn this total surrender. It took him, he says, about a year of constant meditation. And I'd say he's very advanced, far more advanced than I can be. It took him a whole year to reach this total surrender of the mind. And after he achieved it, he said, in his, one night he was talking on meditation, he says, if she had only said, the love of God comes from the total surrender of the mind, if we love God back, he would have achieved it the very next day. You follow me?
No, I'm having trouble right now.
If she had said that the love of God will flow easier through the total surrender of the mind, mm-hmm. if the individual has love in that mind, you understand? But she didn't say that, so he was left to discover this a whole year on his own. So he said, had she continued said that if you had love in the mind, he would have achieved what he was to think. And I realized why Jesus say, love the Lord thy God with all your mind, and all your heart and soul, because this was the key. I even had to go back to the same principle and discover that this was it. That the mind can surrender, and that this divine presence can flow if we keep building love inside the mind. In other words, if we keep saturating our mind with love all the time, love, it flows down back to us. And that's why I said there's no something for nothing in this universe. In other words, you have to give love to get this love.
The problem is, as far as I can see it, though, I mean, it's easy to say, but to do it is a horse of a different color.
Yes.
How could
you still be showing the surrender in the busy activity, the end of conflict, will...
Where your responsibility is?
A surrender is relinquishing our duty. We are not doing our part, and we think we are really surrendering, you know, feeding ourselves. And how do we...
No. You see, when she used the word surrender, this can lead to this type of thinking, as not fulfilling your part in the outward society. She did not mean that.
No, I know. What I mean is the possibility,
What she really meant, you see, surrendering of the mind is that when you sit down to look inside yourself, you should not bring the struggles of the day, the problems of the day, in with you. In other words, do like the Japanese or the Chinese people, they leave their shoes at the door. Leave the thoughts of the day and outside of you now, and surrender now to what inside has. You see. You, and you actually to close the eyes and think love.
Yeah,
right. See, the love of having lived through that day to that moment of meditation. This is what she was trying to bring out to him, that very few of us live love in a grateful way or in a thankful way. We don't live love in a thankful way. We don't exude it thankfully. It's like if it has to be demanded out of us. We do love, or we seem to generate love because there is some need, or we want something for our love. She said to him, actually, is that this love should come up from us as being grateful, of being a mechanism capable of loving. See? We're not grateful to the extent that we can love. You see? That's the thing she was trying to bring out. That if we could be grateful that we are capable of loving, and the greatest center of love is God itself, to where the love actually flows from. This divine love will flow back in. So it's to be grateful to God that you can love Him. This is what the surrender really means. If you can understand what the surrender really means, it's to be grateful to God that you can love God, or that you can use the force of love to love Him, or being grateful to have the opportunity to be in a mechanism that can love Him. You get the idea? This is what she meant by surrendering. It's to let this force flow through you, and you are grateful for the fact that you can be expressing it. See, this is the thing. See, most of us are not grateful for the use of these forces. It goes so deep into our nature that we don't realize that we owe a great deal of thanks or debt to the divine creative intelligence for having planted all these forces in this mechanism.
Well, I wonder if people generally have a realization that love is the powerful force that it is. I know it's been written about, it's been talked about, it's spoken of in the Bible and all that sort of thing, but I wonder, it's sort of like various waves or energies that are existing in the invisible realm. We haven't realized it there. We haven't realized the power. Who realizes really the power of an atom? I mean, we know about it because the scientists have discovered it.
Yeah.
But as an individual, we don't quite understand what the power that's locked up in an atom really is. And I think either through an experience or something only will we gradually come to a place where we realize that love is a powerful force. I think people generally, I think, have gotten to the place where they almost feel that mind power is more powerful than love is, and yet we know, we've read, it's a mental thing we have been handed a number of times, that love is the, what is it, love conquers all, love is the fulfillment of the law, and so all this sort of thing, but I don't think it really has sunk into our concepts deeply that it is that it's quite the force and the power that it is.
If you go down, I was trying to repeat that the person has to achieve a certain degree of growth to be able to express his love, you know, unconditional love towards God or towards his fellow being, that you have to grow up to a certain level, because I know the little things. To experience the state of constant, unconditional love.
Yes, it's true. You see, realization is maturity of love. This is what realization boils itself down to. It's a matured love. See? Now, that's why they call it unconditional. It's a matured love. It's not a love of being in love with someone, or it's not a love to be loved by someone. It is love itself. The fact that it is love, it flows. We are in love with somebody, or so we want somebody to love us.
Yeah, at all levels we get little things that annoy us, or disturb us.
But if we just cannot seem to exude love, or share this love, or pour it out, or give it because it's supposed to be given, without demanding, or regarding it, or hoarding it up, we don't. You see, until we can mature this thing, or it's like aged wine. You know, you have to store it until it becomes aged in itself, or matured in itself, it flows. But you can feel this. This is something you can feel sooner or later.
Yes, that I'm sure the masters, I mean the people, they don't have put in any effort to obtain the calm they maintain in all ups and downs. But we have to put in so much effort
to make love, you know.
Yes.
Well, the thing is, you see, remember, we put the effort to do things strictly because of emotion, not from devotion. Now, the masters, they do everything from devotion.
But don't you require effort to cultivate devotion first?
But you see, the thing, devotion is also effort too, because it takes effort to be devoted. It takes effort to surrender and deny oneself certain things in order to live in this state till it stays permanently. See, like the Christian people have Lent. You know, Lent is a time when they, or a lean period, so you don't eat no candy this weekend, or all through the 40 days. It's a kind of a fasting system. But this is a discipline. It's a form of denial. See? And it brings a strength in itself.
Well, it's a practice that practically permeates after a while, and therefore, I guess you can say it's maturity, because maturity is that stage when we have perfected principles, or when we have what you call grown up, achieved individual status because of our own efforts, and if you make the effort to love and exist because you demand it of yourself for a long enough period, it becomes a permanent part of your makeup then. Mm-hmm. And thereby invites to you the power that love has.
Well, you see, and you understand, if you hate, you release adrenaline into your system.
Yeah.
No. So there's a definite chemical that is responsible for this result called hatred.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there is a definite chemical that is responsible for this result called love, too.
Well, stands to reason there would be. If there is for hate, there would be for love as well.
All right. When you love someone, you light up. Your whole body,
whoa,
you glow. The only chemical that can do this is magnesium and potassium. You take it out of its oil base, so it, or its natural state, it'll light up. So potassium and magnesium are vitally important because it retains a calming effect on us, and at the same time it gives us this optimistic.
Suppose if I ate enough of it, I could
learn. Yes. We do eat a certain portion of those chemicals in our daily diet.
Makes it a little easier, huh?
Yeah, but we're not too aware of it, you see. But it's there just the same, you see. So, who would want to adrenalize if they knew how to phosphorize?
Yeah. That's getting into chemical terms.
Huh? Phosphorus, you see? And magnesium. That's what I say. Who would want to adrenalize if they knew how to phosphorize? It's like a match, you know, you light up.
Well, of course, the feeling is so much more effervescent and wonderful.
Right.
To have
you're bubbling
fun,
all over, right? You're bubbling all over. See, the thing is that you're bubbling all over. See? But you see, the thing is, the chemical result is there only because it's already been integrated and organized from an electrical nature and from an idea nature. It would never have been there if the idea nature and the electrical nature did not select a chemical nature for its end result. See, we are the result of a chemical nature too, you see, because you're looking at the composition of
certain
chemicals. Mm-hmm. Now, there's certain minute quantity and larger quantity, but it's so integrated with its electrical counterpart and the idea counterpart that the moment the idea comes in, the idea of what, hey,
and so it starts doing things.
It starts to set up an electrical relationship. Mm-hmm. So you get, you know, your body starts to go through tremors. Mm-hmm. And the tremors have to burn some chemical. Mm-hmm. So it seeks the chemical that it stimulates it through. It seeks the one in that particular area of the body to release.
So and of course, the same thing takes place in your life.
Right. All your emotional natures are set up the same. You see, this divine intelligence organized this structure so uniquely that the thought, the idea patterns set up this electrical movement that triggers off this mechanical or chemical movement. See? So we are interlinked all the way.
Every day I have a higher respect for this statement that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. And for one reason or another, something shows up. I saw a movie, just excerpts of a movie, which showed the physical makeup, how the bloodstream and the red corpuscles move through the blood veins, you know, and the white ones come along and attack anything that is of a foreign nature in the body. And one just has the highest respect for this innate capacity of the body. You just can't believe it. It's almost a miracle to watch how the body functions.
You see, the thing is, we have not really evaluated ourselves. There was a time when this body was looked at with scorn and disgust.
Yeah, the thing of sin.
Right. The flesh is evil and so forth. That was the greatest falsity of philosophy ever passed on the human being. That's the inhumanity of human beings, the human being.
Mm-hmm.
Until, and even when the Master Jesus was on the body, or any other master, would make a person conscious that this mechanism was the mechanism to work with, it still could not seep in. Even today it doesn't seep in. We are so imprinted in our conscious, so we're programmed to think that this mechanism is incapable.
Mm-hmm.
And once it's impregnated, it's going to take a long time to get rid of it, of this incapable. But if you realize that it's capable, that's the only mechanism that has been chosen. Now this goes further. It's the only mechanism that has been chosen for divinity to work with. He didn't choose no other kind of mechanism to work with. Now, this is choice now. We're talking about divine choice. We're talking of freedom of choice. What other mechanism was chosen for divinity? None other was chosen. This was the one that was chosen. Flesh. Come, let us make man in our own image. This was choice now. This was a decision. And likeness. Male and female created him.
Our father and male.
So the thing is, and he breathed the breath of life into man, and man became a living soul. So this was a definite decision, a definite choice on the divine part to use this mechanism as the only media possible to work out the divinity. One cannot recognize it until one begins to live with it. That the divinity is not something like a superior being with a pair of horns, you know, walking around, beep, 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 beep.
Like the Martian, you mean?
The divinity is the pure naturalness of love that flows. And it's in that state that thoughts now can begin to materialize. You see, let's look at it this way. If you had all the gifts in the world available to you, but was denied the right to materialize your thoughts, which would you choose?
Well, I know right off. Anybody go start putting any inhibitions on my mind, right then I'm rearing to buck.
But you have access to everything in this universe.
Yeah, but that,
but you cannot think of materialize
me.
A thought.
Uh-huh.
Now, if you have the ability to materialize your thoughts, then you have exactly what the divinity has. Because the divinity is a result of a materialized thought. It's constantly materializing itself.
Well, in other words, then what you say, you are being and functioning as a miniature God. In other words,
creator.
The microcosm,
right.
The macrocosm.
See, we cannot escape the inherent quality to create. That's why the mind cannot cease to think. It's constantly thinking how to create. It's constantly striving to create. It may not know what it wants to create. It may not even have an idea what it's going to create. But it's constantly striving, constantly craving to demonstrate its creativity. It doesn't know why. Only because it is part of the creative structure.
Well, that is the thing, I think, because if man is made in the image and likeness of God, he has the same creative
right.
urge within him that God is creating.
God cannot stop creating. See, when he created the universe, he had to go out to create man in order for man to look into himself. See, so he cannot stop the process. So he has left man now with the burden of trying to create. In other words, God was smart. He took off after he made man.
Yeah.
Yeah, he took a rest. He said, "You guys are going to create
now.
You do it. You play a mechanic."
It's a pretty dirty trick.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, one of the master lessons, he said, God is really ashamed that he ever started. But he can't help it.
Right. You see, the thing is, the creative principle must go on in the creation, because that's why he says everything was made for man, not man for the thing. See, if man was made for anything, he was only made to realize divinity within himself. As a creative force, because everything that he needs is already made for him. Everything are here, right here around him. You know, the idea of a rabbit, he can't even take it out of the universe. Just the idea of a rabbit exists. With all his creative ability, man cannot eradicate that idea out of the universe. And he cannot add another idea to this universe yet. You see, he can't get rid of the idea of a rabbit, and he cannot add another idea to what is here already. So he's caught in the principle, is he? Because he would not know what to add that would be missing here. And he would not know what to take out that would be short here. You couldn't take out anything because it was there, you see? And he would not know what to add. Well, what would be missing to him in this universe? He doesn't know. But the creative intelligence has left him with everything here ready to play the game of creation. That is to realize himself. We're endowed with this creative nature now.
Again, you're just down to the plain realization. What it's all here is a matter of just realizing it.
Yes. Now, that's why, you see, the Master Jesus put it this way. the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. The things were made for man, even whatever it is man needs or wants, if he realizes that these things were made already for him, it'll manifest. No. The more simple and the more natural you live, the quicker these things will flow into manifestation. Now, you would not have to create. You see, the thing is, if the Creator made everything for his creation, and since the creation could not remove any manifestation out of the existence, and the creation cannot put in anything new within the existence that would add to it, then the creation itself, which is us, is left to play little Napoleons, you know, marching around with a creative sword in our sort of a creative idea that we can create, but we don't create. What we're doing strictly as creation, we are rearranging all that is here to suit our needs. We're rearranging it to suit our wants and making a mess of it to the same time.
Wants, not needs.
Is it true then that then what we are trying, what we are wanting is in line with the divine plan, it sort of works, and when it is in the opposite direction, that's where
messes come.
Yeah, right.
Right. What we need is actually in line with the divine plan and will. What we want is not in line with the divine plan. But you see the thing, if this was not bestowed upon us to decipher between or discriminate between want and need, if this was never given to us, and if we were never given the opportunity to experience when I say, don't go here, go there, don't do this to get there, we wouldn't do anything, see? We would be strictly like this object, standing here, see? Now, this object, remember, is still stone. Only you're looking at a different expression of that stone. And because, through the principle of change, we impregnate this particular stone in this new shape. Was this ore. It was ore taken out of the earth, which had to be melted down, then had to be extruded, then come out looking like this. Now, it came out as ore, and if we put fire to it, it'll come back like ore, not less but carbon. You see? It'll go looking exactly where it came from. So, we realize that we are only rearranging these forces to suit our needs and wants.
In our ignorance, because, well, the what I was trying to get at, I guess, is the fact that we've torn up the earth in order to try to create new forms out of the matter that exists in the earth. And, for instance, like in extending our hearing, we have built the telephone, and we thought we had to have it because we didn't know how to go within and build the inner hearing. But we build from the outside first, only to maybe ultimately, and maybe it's in line with the plan of the Creator that we refine and beautify and build the rough elements of matter into refined elements of matter, such as anything like a telephone, the microscope, the telescope, all of these things that are really extensions of ourselves, but we have to first find out that they're on the outer and then learn how to grow to the inner ones.
Yes, this is true. This is what you're saying is true. You see, Yukteswar wrote his Holy Science. And in his Holy Science, he shows that the external evolution is a preparatory movement for the internal evolution. One can't work without the other. Now, but he also shows, by no mechanical process will you arrive at total comprehension of your existence. Because you don't have enough lifetime, enough body form, enough diseaseless atmosphere to perform this mechanical movement to arrive at total comprehension. Now, yet, within the same body, in the same brain mechanism, from an internal approach, we can have this total comprehension, which is consciousness. Now, the picture 2001 is a living example in photography of what Yukteswar was talking about. We saw, if you have ever seen this picture...
I got lost.
You see the mechanical advancement, and you see the slow methodical process it will take to go from one planet to the other, let alone the entire galaxy.
Yeah.
Yet, in the end of the picture, you saw he bridged it by consciousness.
Well, you saw it. I didn't.
You see, it was only through consciousness did he bridge infinity. And only through consciousness could you perceive what he was showing through photography, what infinity was.
Yeah, I missed it.
Well, you see, the thing is this. Consciousness was color and light. And from Jupiter, he says, onward into infinity. Now, the spacecraft could not travel into infinity because it would have to travel at the speed of light squared. Mm-hmm. And you got umpteen millions of open space out there, which there is not going to come to no end. So, the man, if he's going to travel, let's say, uh, 80 years in space, mm-hmm. to go from one planet to another planet?
A lifetime?
It's not possible. No. But in consciousness, he did it. You see, when he opened the door, remember that in the final part of the picture, it was a matter of argument between what the human mind is and what a mechanical imprinting mind would do. He decided that he was still a human being and that he could outthink and outdecide what the mechanical machine could do. So, when the mechanical machine refused to open the door, he still figured a way how to get back in.
Yeah.
He turned the little craft that he was in, and he pressed the button where the explosive bolts were, and threw himself by the shock and the pressure mm-hmm. back into the capsule. Yeah. Now, when he got in there, he still did not lose his sense of awareness. He was still a living creature. Mm-hmm. You understand? Now, the computer could not reach out and grapple him.
No, that's true.
You understand? It could only have done that when he was outside in that machine, which it did to the other man when the man got out of the machine. He took the machine and killed the man. But this other fellow did not get out of his machine. This other fellow was in control of his machine. And the other fellow made the attempt to get back into the second machine which he came out first by his own volition, showing that willpower is still there. Through his own volition, he then walked into the entire compartment and started cutting up that compartment, cutting up that whole unit.
Yeah, all the various all right. connections.
So he performed what is called a mechanical lobotomy on that unit. Mm-hmm. This is the same thing that you'd perform on
the brain,
you see. He just cut back certain areas now. But when he was confronted with the realization that there was a possibility of life in space, from what the recording showed him, then the shock was too much for him. See, it came to a shock to him then that the possibility that he was not the only being traveling around in space. There could have been, they had discovered some intelligent form of life that deliberately took a monolith and stuck it in the ground, as if it was deliberately stuck there in a tremendous rays of vibration. This shock was too great for him. And this broke into consciousness. Then it was all consciousness. He slipped away into consciousness. Now, what he did experience was his three natures, because he saw the three natures of the man at the end. He saw him eating like an old man.
Yeah.
This was his physical body now, back on Earth, in his familiar environment. The things that we were familiar with. I said to that man there tonight, if you go into a place and you have no maps of where you're going and don't know what you're going, what you're going to find out? Just your familiarity is what you take with you. He was familiar with the bathroom, he was familiar with the table and food, and that's what the man took back with him. Mm-hmm. In infinity, what are you going to take? Pure consciousness and pure energy. Mm-hmm. You understand? This picture is a typical example of what happened. He had nothing to take with him in pure consciousness and pure energy, but the familiar things he had to relate to. Now, the astronaut was himself again looking at his astral body. See, this was his astral body looking. This was the one that took flight into space. This is the one that we have, that we know can go away to space. It is looking at the physical body with its familiarities, with disgust, because it's so ridiculous to say, here's a man with his pots and pans and plates and table and everything, and here he went out into space and came back, and well, it's all there is only energy and motion. It's kind of, it seems kind of ridiculous to look at this thing, as if you were seeing yourself, you see? Now, then again, he saw himself as a shriveled up old man, dying on the bed.
Yeah.
Now, this was the idea. He was man. This is his idea body. The mere fact that he was man, he was a living creature. He saw himself, the very archetypal principle of what he was, he saw that he was man. You see, the cause of his being. He saw the causal effect, that this had an effect on his own makeup, that this cause was him lying there, and here was him eating over here, and here he was in this astral suit, this space suit, his three selves. One that was free to fly into space, one that was confined to related ideas, and here was the one that had a cause now, facing infinity. And what did it do? The causal body, if you want to call it, reached up to touch what? The monolith. As if to say the creative principle. And when it did reach up to this monolith to touch the creative principle, what did we see? An embryo came out.
Oh, yes.
The infinity of life came out back. So you see what I mean? So the soul, which is again life, the principle of soul, God breathed into man the breath of life, and man became a living soul. You see, the embryo was floating around in space looking for another location where to come down again to start the whole thing all over again. So in infinity itself, we can only realize this thing in consciousness. We're never going to realize this thing in a physical manner. You see, even, let's say, 100 years from now, we have families living in space trailers. You know, like the nomadic, all right, they're like, we call it space gypsies now. And they're procreating and doing everything up in space and living out there. Still, the planet Earth goes on.
The same principles.
Right.
In
the mechanical world will go ahead of the psychological world, but there is no way to resolve by the mechanical world the total awareness.
Uh-huh.
There is no way possible for this, because the first thing, you have so many light years to travel from one galaxy to another, let alone one planet to the other. How are you going to resolve this thing mechanically in relation to your life? Now, in that picture you saw, they put three bodies in a state of hibernation or suspended animation. That's what you call samadhi too, you know, it's a form of suspended animation. It's only a mechanical way of demonstrating samadhi to the individual or suspension. And all the functions that went on was there. They were all showing within that mechanism. They were all of the functions.
Yeah, all the little lines and wiggles.
Right,
the
good.
The
now, they could travel in space endlessly without being affected, providing they had some way to maintain the machine that they were traveling in.
Mm-hmm.
And if the pilot didn't get old too fast, you know, so. But we realized that the mechanical machinery could not bring home or resolve the awareness inside. It was an obvious thing, it didn't resolve it.
Mm-hmm.
But what resolved it for that, Kubrick was trying to show how it was possible to resolve this thing in consciousness, was when he took a chance to demonstrate the survivability of the human body against the external pressures, how this human body will still survive under certain extreme cases of chance, and how it will still exhibit its ability to utilize its will. You see, between the two craft, there had to be a certain area of space that was not protected from the vibrations of that outer space. Because remember, he had no helmet, and the computer told him, how is he going to get back inside without his helmet? You know? And without the helmet, he has no way to breathe and survive It's just like in your helmet in the on the water swimming. If it comes off, or you're too far down low, then not enough oxygen, you get killed too, see? Pressure will blow up. So, can man survive? Can man make the desperate effort to try to survive under such an extreme condition? Or would man just give up there and never make an effort? Would he never use his will to demonstrate one more level of his surviving capacities?
Isn't this one of the reasons, or at least it's been a theory of mine, one of the reasons why we haven't demonstrated a greater awareness and ability before, and that is we haven't been tested enough. I mean, we have existed in a very easy existence, and nothing has put us to the test.
Well, no, this is true to a certain extent. We are being tested. I'll show you why we're being tested. We don't recognize how we've been tested, and only because we've developed the dexterity to survive with what we survive with, that we stay alive. One good example is, 50 years ago, no automobile, you rode in a carriage, horse and buggy. And if you didn't know how to drive it, and somebody fired a pistol, it took off.
Yeah, the horse went in.
Right. And it'll turn over and kill you too, right? So that was a challenge too in itself. Now, but in those days, the percentage of such hazards were very low.
Yeah.
They weren't magnified. Now, along came a young man called Henry, and his last name was Ford. And he started a whole new revolution. He gave you 300 horses to pull your carriage. And he called it the Mustang. Right. So he gives you the asphalt jungle to drive on now, you know. And you get on this asphalt road and you start going to nowhere.
Real fast.
Now your survivability. And the tests are here now, because look how much reflexes you got to develop.
Well, that's true. I agree. But by and large, I would say that our tests of ingenuity are really survival tests.
Yes, they are survival tests. I'll show you why.
Mm-hmm.
Even for a master or any spiritual person, it's a survival test. I'll show you, in my own case, I have to use my case as an example.
Yeah.
I learned to drive in an automatic car.
Mm-hmm.
Never drove in a standard stick shift.
Mm-hmm.
Before these folks came back one Sunday, after my surprise, down comes a truck, the stick shift. And you take back the car that you're renting, and you drive this stick shift.
Wow.
No, I never drove stick shift. So I gotta go learn to drive all over now.
That was a jerky drive,
I'll bet. Well, they took off, and the next morning I had to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
I never drove this thing. And here I am behind the steering wheel, kind of thinking what to do now. I drive this thing or smash it up. Or survive with this thing. There, this is the survival pattern again comes back. Do I survive? Or do I give up right here? It's called, the boss says, I quit work, I can't drive your truck, I don't know how to drive. So, get another man. Or I survive and learn to adapt to this thing. So, I'm behind the wheel and figuring it out. The mechanics of the thing. Can't come to the decision. And I look at the watch. It's 8 o'clock and the other guy is waiting for me to pick him up. So I heard him. I said, well, I'm going to concentrate. I said, Henry Ford, you invented this machinery, you must have drove it too. Well, you can drive it right now. Wherever your consciousness is, however you devised it, invented this machinery, you're going to guide me to drive this thing. That was funny. All of a sudden, I begin to feel well. Turn the ignition. I turned the ignition and the car is in neutral, so the motor started revving up. Yeah. Go into first gear.
And I get my foot out, yeah.
So feeling around. Push in the pedal, the clutch, yeah. Shift in the gear. As you said, the jerky ride. Moment I release the foot from the clutch. And it stalls. Pull.
Yeah.
Well, by the time I got out with first gear out of the yard to the first stop sign, I was turned on that motor boy 20 times. Turn around and around because it was stalls about 20 times before I got to the first. I didn't even go to second gear yet. So you can imagine. You can imagine somebody see me stalling or come along with a brand new truck too, out of state. Something is wrong. But I went down the side road and I'm driving in first for a long time. I haven't switched into second. The cars are behind me, I don't worry. I'm going along in first gear till I get behind me. Switched into second and then I start going. Now at the stop, don't know what to do. If the clutch, I press on the brakes and turn the motor off. Well, survival is the thing. I stop it where no car would hit me. Because I don't think I was about to stop this thing. So here's the other fellow waiting for me. He's across the street. He walks. I said, well, I said, you can drive. He says, well, no, you're driving it. He says, you value your life, then you better drive it. He says, oh, come on, it's easy. Well, I said, you drive it, let me see it. Maybe I'll get a better idea what I'm not doing right. So he got in, he switched on, and pushed. Then I watched, first. Went on the second, finally third. So I dropped him off at the workplace, and there was another fellow with him. I said, look, you two fellas are going to work today. I'm going to spend $10 on 2 gallons of gas, and I'm going to learn to drive this truck before this day is over. The boss will pay for this gas because he says that I'm going to learn to drive this truck. So I spent 3 hours driving all around in the Dutchess area trying to back up anyway, feel like, oh man, I got the master truck.
You got it mastered.
But survival was the thing. And you can see how survival plays an important part in bringing a pressure to bear.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if it was not the survival principle involved, that the responsibility now of having to take care of the thing, I don't think the pressure would come on.
I don't think so either, but I do think that's an important thing in pressuring us into, a financial reverse, a bad health, or something like this, usually pushes us in a corner and makes us think for once, what is the cause of it, or what can I do to overcome it?
Yeah, it's where Darwin got his idea of the survival of the fittest. Because the fittest are those who would adapt faster.
Mm-hmm.
The fittest is not the strongest, you know. Most people think the fittest are the strongest. It's not true. The greater adaptability the mechanism will adjust to is the more it will survive in an environment. But if it can't adapt, no matter how strong it is, it will be lost. This is what you begin to realize, that it's the adaptability. That's why man, being such an adaptable creature, can survive in so many different areas on the earth. Whereas certain animals cannot. When they're taken out from their natural, they just die out.
Well, as hard as meditation is, you wouldn't think it was a natural thing.
No. You must realize this is true. Meditation is not a natural thing. Yet meditation is a natural thing.
It's a natural way back, probably.
See, it sounds kind of, you're contradicting yourself, right?
Yeah.
But it is not. So, It is not natural for the individual to want peace, because his life is geared to action, because his thinking capacity, his creative nature, strives for him to constantly demonstrate it, constantly manifesting, mm-hmm. and therefore it's constantly pouring out. You know what I mean? Now, but he's creating or manifesting or rearranging creation that is causing hazards to his existence, is causing his chances of survival to lessen and diminish in the environment by his mistakes of wrong choice and wrong decisions. You understand? No. Therefore, meditation would come very difficult to such a person in the early phases of his revising his consciousness. Now, it would be difficult in the course. In fact, it would be an alien thing to him that he would have to shut down in order to perceive his mistakes, in order to make adjustments for his mistakes, in order to now decide or act correctly. You see, that's why meditation would seem as an alien thing. But as soon as he bridges or make the break, then meditation becomes a natural thing. But it's that period in between. That is the period that is always so hard. But as soon as you experience the peace, and you experience the awareness of what is going on, then this inner strength is there. Now, you'll always find people want to challenge your peace, you know. So, oh, you meditating? You peaceful? Let's see how much. So they light a cigarette, touch it too. How peaceful can you be then? You know, this is the thing. Once you start to go back into yourself and you don't conform to the conventional way of thinking, people think or begin to think that something's wrong. So right away you are challenged. See, this is one of the peculiar things about the spiritual life. If the challenges don't exist, this is where they exist. It exists when people begin to think what you are trying to accomplish is not what it really appeared to be until you put it to the test. It's like a person wanted to drive. He's not a driver until he goes and take an examination, being testing. So we find out that testing and repeated testing is what produces the strength, the challenges that make for strength. Without it, we don't have it. Now, like in that 2001 picture, if that man was not tested to the extent to make the jump from one craft to the other, he would not know that he could have done it. You see? He would still live under the illusion or the idea or the condition that he was limited in space.
And that one vehicle was all that would do him any good. Well, last I know a little more about 2001. That thing went over my head like a bolt of lightning, frankly.
Now, I heard that was interesting from the standpoint, but I never had seen it.
Well, I went to see it, and I didn't know what I was looking at. I did part of it, but...
Really worth seeing once you told me about it from a metaphysical standpoint. Mm-hmm. Now I understand it. I haven't seen it.
Y'all get two more of my dinner. I'm making a choice. Oh, it's just getting nice cold in here. Yeah. And I didn't have anything on. It's just 50, I think. I don't know. 40, I think. I really don't know. Oh. Tobacco, probably. Yeah, sure.
Help yourself.
Hey, we sure gonna have some snoring on that tape.
And I wanted to go talk, and I would have been saying something. Maybe I can stand it.
Do you know, Louise had her glasses off there when she did. She looked just like Joan Crawford. She really did.
I
think
they could
look it up. Have you started doing your hair differently, or...
She has a new hairdress.
Huh?
New hairdress. New hairdress.
Oh.
This is about full on the radio. We just got so finished.
Well, the new hairdo is very Joan Crawford.
Not the hairdo, it's